Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. And this is episode 50, so it's a big 50. It's a pretty big number. And today I am in Lawrence, Kansas, at the University of Kansas, and I am with Tom Tuozzo, who is professor of philosophy at the University of Kansas. And Tom is the author of the forthcoming book with Cambridge University Press entitled Plato's Charmides, Positive Elenchus in a Socratic Dialogue. And that is coming out imminently. He's also the author of a number of articles in the area of ancient Greek philosophy and moral theory, and I'll just mention a couple here. Knowing Meno Blindfolded, The Dialectic of Essence and Quality in the Meno, which appeared in selected papers from the Seventh Symposium Platonicum in 2007. Also, What's Wrong with These Cities, The Social Dimension of Sophrosyne in Plato's Charmides, which was published in the Journal of the History of Philosophy. And another article that was published in the Journal of History of Philosophy was the General Account of Pleasure in Plato's Philebus, which was also published in Journal of Philosophy in 1996. That's a bit of an older one. And he has many other articles, which we'll put a link to on the blog. So it's really a pleasure to have you, Tom, come to the Digital Dialogue.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
Actually, I guess I came to you, so here I am in Kansas. I appreciate the invitation to come and talk about my own book and also to give a talk on Plato and Socrates and politics, which I did yesterday. So you have agreed to come on the Digital Dialogue today to talk about your article, which appeared recently in Epoche,
right,
entitled How Dynamic is Aristotle's Efficient Cause? And so I think that was a paper that you gave at the APS.
That's right. That's right.
Well, yes, and Tom is a friend of the APS, and we have become friends through the APS,
right.
So that's another great aspect of the Ancient Philosophy Society, and I really appreciate it. Tom's, I think, in the last few years have been really much more active in the society.
I've enjoyed it. Met a lot of nice people.
Yeah. It's great. So maybe you could begin just by telling us a little bit about what you're arguing in the essay, and then we'll take it from there. I think there's a lot of issues about the relationship between the efficient cause and the final cause, and some very, I think, interesting approach you take in the article. So maybe you could talk a little bit just about what you were doing in the article.
Well, the article started off with I thought it seemed like a rather small topic, which then opened up into a whole new way of looking at
Aristotle.
As they
often do.
Yes, they do. Yeah, because in the literature, you know, there we think that the efficient cause is the easiest one to understand.
Right.
You know, we all know what when one thing knocks over another,
right,
you know, it's caused it to move. But when Aristotle talks about the efficient cause, he says some things that don't really fit that picture.
Mm-hmm.
He will talk about an art often as an efficient cause,
right,
and the soul as an efficient cause,
right,
and especially with certain understandings of the soul, as you know, maybe those with functionalist understandings, with some kind of supervenient understanding of the soul, it's hard to see how that could be an efficient cause.
Right.
And so how art could be an efficient cause either.
Yeah.
So people say, well, there are two different kinds of efficient cause, those that are really efficient and those that don't really do anything, but they call it efficient for some other reason.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm never happy with those kinds of artificial distinctions that strike me as artificial.
Right, sure.
So I went into it and I thought, well, no, actually, these are the paradigmatic kinds of efficient causes.
So these causes, like way an art causes something,
right, or mm-hmm, or the soul,
the soul, right, right, mm-hmm,
and that other more mundane kinds of we would think simpler kinds, like a billiard ball striking,
right,
another, actually are more complicated in his model, and
uh-huh,
that the original model is this other kind.
Mm-hmm.
And so in exploring it, actually then writing up, I thought, okay, I will share this.
Right.
But then I was really struck, actually, in writing this, the original speech version of this, struck by a passage from the Phaedo that Aristotle goes back to in talking,
right,
about efficient causes. And I began to entertain the view that he's really very much influenced by Anaxagoras.
Uh-huh.
And Anaxagoras has mind being the call, the primary efficient cause.
Mm-hmm.
And it just struck me that the mind is very different from the things that it causes. You have a very asymmetrical relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of resonated with Aristotle's frequent talk about, well, there, not every mover is moved. There are some movers that are that move without themselves being moved.
Right.
And so it's a kind of a one-way street there between mm-hmm. the causes of a different kind of thing than the effect,
mm-hmm.
than the thing that is affected.
Right.
And so that's how I developed that.
So let's go back just for a second to the passage from the Phaedo. Okay. So you refer to that. And Aristotle himself refers to the passage from the Phaedo and talks about how Socrates was enthralled with Anaxagoras' notion that mind might be the ultimate cause. And then Socrates, if I'm remembering correctly, gets frustrated that, you know, he was excited about reading right. Anaxagoras. And as he read, he realized, well, actually, he doesn't really use mind as an explanatory cause at all, really. Socrates suggests he should have.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Right. So you wanted to go back to that passage at least to talk about how Aristotle seems to have something like that relationship between mind and the things it might cause in the natural world as a kind of paradigm.
Right.
Uh-huh.
I was going to say, if you think of the kind what Socrates complains about in the Phaedo
right.
is that you're not using the teleological resources that mind
right.
would bring with it.
Right. So that's functioning as a final clause rather than an official clause.
Well, no. I think a combination of two.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
And instead you're using these other kinds of mechanistic, let's call them, causes.
Okay.
And I think that what Plato, I'm not really, in this regard, not so much focusing on the final causation stuff
right.
there.
So right.
I think there's something powerful about the idea that struck them that the cause should be a distinct in kind
right.
from the things on which it acts.
So that's the feature that you want to highlight in the essay, that maybe asymmetrical is not right, but non-reciprocal relationship, right, between the cause and the effect. And that's what you're arguing in the article that Aristotle wants to touch upon.
Right.
And then emphasize. So maybe you could say a little bit more about the power of, or let's say the paradigmatic model that you think Aristotle's operating with for the efficient cause.
Be happy to.
Okay.
it's a little outlandish, I think.
Okay.
I mean,
it's a digital dialogue. We can deal with it. You know?
Because there's a very strange passage in The Generation of Corruption, which I refer to,
mm-hmm.
where he seems to have an odd Platonic moment. When I taught this in my a seminar a few years ago, because did not know what to make of it.
Uh-huh.
Because those are always the passages I like best about Aristotle. Hello,
right, exactly.
Why would we want to rub those away and make it more easier to understand?
Right.
Anyway, so, but he's talking about most causes, physical causes,
mm-hmm.
are have this reciprocal nature. Something
mm-hmm.
heats something up, and it gets cooled down as it does so, and so forth. But then he says, but if there was a heat that didn't have any matter,
right.
if there was a matterless heat, it would heat things without ever cooling down.
Right.
It would not be reciprocally affected. And so I think, so now that there is no such kind of heat, but I think there are such kinds of causes,
mm-hmm.
the primary kinds of causes, and I think maybe substantial forms, maybe even go broader than just soul, but substantial forms are of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly soul.
I know, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think it is such as to operate, and one of the main things, odd things he talks about in the first book of the Dianema is how the soul's not moved. There's no
right.
way the soul's moved, and none of the senses in which things can be moved is the soul moved.
Right.
And then, but it is an unmoved source of motion. So I think it moves the body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think just as the impossibly existing immaterial heat would just heat things up forever because it would never be reciprocally affected. So I think the soul is not affected by its animation of the body. It animates the body. The body's affected, and through mm-hmm. time and wear and tear and so forth, it's no longer such as to be able to be moved by the soul.
Right.
And the soul is essentially a thing that moves the body.
Right.
And so that it can't exist without a body that can be moved by it, and so they sort of perish simultaneously.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, so
that, was an interesting. I mean, that was an. I remember as I read that line in the essay, was struck by. On the one hand, I was thinking that okay, now you're going to go. You really sort of have this picture of the definite disembodied soul, all of that, but yet because of what you just said, namely that the soul without that which it moves perishes also, or at least, you know, dissipates or whatever we want to call it. So you're able to retain the idea that is critical for Aristotle, which is that the soul and the body are belong together in the sense that the soul is the mover of the body and the soul can't exist without a body to move, or doesn't exist without.
Right.
And yet we have this radical difference between the soul, which is not physical, so whatever kind of way it moves is not mechanistic.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think that's one of the powerful things about your account of the efficient cause is you force us outside of, you know, the Humean mm-hmm. billiard ball kind of model. But then how does that, is it even a fair question to ask about how that, the bridge gets bridged, how the gap gets bridged. If there is a gap, maybe that right. issue is thinking about it as a distinction. I mean, I always run into this, the tendency in, you know, I think modern thinking to think of the distinction between soul and body rather than their belonging together, right. which isn't, I sort of had the sense that that's what the Greeks sort of began with, the observation of things being moved and on the basis of that, you can have a sense of what the soul might be.
Right, mm-hmm. right. That's a very good question, and I don't have a real answer to it. Except, I'm not satisfied with my answer
okay.
at this stage. But I do, I do want to say somehow that this is the paradigmatic kind of causation. It can't be understood in any other kind. You know, it's the most basic form mm-hmm. of causation. Mm-hmm. And so therefore you can't, it's not going to be explained in mechanistic terms or really any other kind of terms.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm sensitive to the idea that, you know, the way I put this seems to open up a dualism that yeah. we don't want to associate with Aristotle, you know,
right,
and
right.
That's why and some other people who responded to this have raised this question, and I want to insist, as I, you know, did in my statement a minute ago,
yeah.
That, you know, and somehow it's part of the, you know, the nature of the soul to be a causal power of, you know, moving the thing that it's in.
Right.
So that if it doesn't have a thing in which it is to exist, it doesn't exist.
Right, right.
But I do have to think that more through. But I mean, I really want to try to think of this. You have the unity, the living thing,
right.
the unity, and but the to use a sexist cliche, I mean, a sexist metaphor, the thing that wears the pants, you know, right. the thing is the soul. And so it's, whereas I think some philosophers look back to Aristotle and they're trying to see him as a middle way between dualism and something else. They really want to focus on the physicalism as somehow the fundamental layer of the
right,
aspect
right.
of the living thing. And I think he really thinks now these souls, they're closely connected to body in a way that I need mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. think about more. But no, it's one thing that the thing that constructs the body, that keeps mm-hmm. the body in shape and digests the food, mm-hmm, turns mm-hmm. it into flesh and all that stuff. I think right. you know.
And I think in that sense, when Aristotle talks about the soul as an activity of the body, then you can see why that would be. I mean, the activity is not physical. I mean, mm-hmm. although it manifests itself in physical terms as the body, you know, moves and lives and exists, but that when that activity is no longer happening, when the body is no longer doing that, then the souls, neither the soul nor the body exist in the same way that they did before, even though the body's now a corpse, for example.
Right.
So I think, but maybe the way to think about it is to refer to your own example of the arts, of an art. So what, if I'm, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but your part of your point is, okay, the art of doctoring, let's say, is an efficient cause in this kind of paradigmatic way. Mm-hmm. It itself is not a physical being, the art of doctoring, right? And yet it causes things, right? But of course you go and you also go and say, well, it causes things by the medium of the doctor doing certain kinds of things.
Right.
So I wonder if we could just think a little bit more about that as the paradigm example. And what that helps us understand about, you know, either the soul or the nature of efficient causality, you know?
Right. I mean, it is very striking that he will often say it's the sculptor, but really the art of sculpting, you know, that causes the statue.
Exactly.
Like, how is that again? You know? it's really interesting the way he uses, I mean, this is sort of the obverse of when he talks about using artifacts like the bronze sphere to illustrate a substance.
Right.
You know, there's something that's the same and something that's very different. Right. So I think what's the same here, back to our case, is you have a form. You know, the science is, the art is basically the form of the product, right? Mm-hmm. The understanding of health. And it's a form, an immaterial form. It's of health, you know, without the matter, the body, that's in the person's mind. And it is, you know, we're moving from an immaterial to a material product.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what he wants to emphasize there, because that's sort of the paradigmatic, I think, you know, the distinction between the efficient cause and the thing that the art of doctoring is not affected at all.
Right.
And it's by when people are cured, you know, it just stays what it is. And it's the patient that gets cured.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he likes to use it for that reason now. But then again, it's not the true paradigmatic case. It's because it's an artificial, an artificial thing. So you do need to have, you need, as he says, right, in the metaphysics, mm-hmm. about, well, you know, you can either cure or not, or indeed you could kill with your knowledge of medicine, right?
Right.
So you need the desire to come in, because to determine how this is used, you know, what affects the art of medicine in you, producers in the world, you have to have a desire to use it, you know, to cure this person or, you know, not. And so then it becomes, when we want to give the fuller picture of what happens in artistic production, we have to look at it as a term, as a natural action, you know, that this person is doing with things.
So I like that point that you made about that the bronze sphere, because it's something that's always a huge issue in the sense that, you know, Aristotle seems to often thinks about the distinction between form and matter in terms of, you know, statues and bronze spheres and things like that. And I have always taken that as a kind of heuristic device, not that he thinks that bronze spheres are paradigmatic substances, this helps us delineate the difference between form and matter. That will help us understand the more organic nature of substances, which are the paradigmatic things for substances for him. But of course, part of the problem is it also complicates things, because having the distinction between form and matter is a kind of perversion of organic things in the sense that, or of our understanding of organic things in the sense that these two, form and matter, really aren't separate or in organic things.
Right.
So I wonder if there's something so as you're saying, there's something analogous now with efficient causes and arts, precisely because they are actual productions.
Mm-hmm.
This is a model of production, and again, you know, one of the critiques of Aristotle is that the model of production is too paramount in his mind, and it kind of makes him you know, it bleeds over into the more natural world. And I think there are ways we can account for that. But in any case, what you said I thought was interesting, and I wonder if it helps us, or at least helped me think a little bit more about the relationship between efficient and final causes. So mm-hmm. you said the art of doctoring is kind of an efficient cause for the production of health in a patient. Now, health itself functions as a kind of final cause, right? That this is it's also not material. It's right. an ideal that we're going for, and what it means in each context is going to be different. And that's part of what the doctoring art is being able to attend to that it is to translate that ideal into the concrete realities of the patient.
Mm-hmm.
But so, I mean, in that sense, are you arguing that the efficient cause and the final cause, if we take the art of doctoring and the mm-hmm. health as
paradigm, right.
that they are similar in the sense of being, you know, at play in a certain sense in any kind of causal account. Well, maybe not any kind, but let's just say in this account,
in this example. Clearly, I mean. That's true. They're the same in form.
Right.
And it's interesting because that in a passage from the Generation and Corruption, where he sort of is attending to the difference between formal and final cause,
right.
then says he will say that, well, you know, he says the health that is produced. I don't know that mm-hmm. when the healthy person, the health that the healthy person has when they're healthy, when the sick person has when they become healthy,
right?
Okay? That is not an efficient cause because it only comes after the change is done. The change is that
right.
it's present when the change is done. So I mean, so he said you would only metaphorically could you or kind of metaphoron whatever uh-huh. you want to translate that
uh-huh.
Could you call that an efficient cause? But the efficient cause is really the art of medicine.
Uh-huh.
But of course, we know. What arts are those forms without the matter. So, I mean, I think they're obviously the same in form, and just he wants to be careful not to, you know, give the implication of some kind of backwards causation, you know, that
right.
the health that's going to be in this person is somehow a cause.
I see.
Cause, yeah.
Right. So it's not health as a final cause that's sort of coming in the front and functioning
yeah.
as an efficient cause.
Right.
But they are, so as you say, formally similar. So maybe we could talk a little bit about, you point to an interesting, so I've always emphasized this passage in the physics where he says, well, kind of the efficient final and formal causes mm-hmm. are kind of all the same, and there's the material cause, which is kind of just different from all of the other.
Yeah, right,
so
right.
it seems to sort of reduce things to two causes, which we could call form and matter, form having both the final dimension and the efficient dimension. But then you point to a different passage later on where mm-hmm. he seems to exclude the efficient cause, right? Is that the efficient cause is kind of the one that's peculiar from the others. Is that the passage that you are you recalling that?
I'm not recalling.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. There was a point that you were emphasizing the difference between the efficient cause and the other three causes. And the part of the point.
Oh, there is. I guess towards the beginning,
yes,
where he's
right.
saying. The people before him never really understood
right.
what an efficient cause
yeah,
was.
Yeah, exactly.
And some people put it in the form,
right.
and some people put it in the matter. But there really must be a third thing.
Right.
Yeah. So
right.
you know, and
right.
You know, and so he's got the Platonist,
yeah.
you know, with the form and
yeah.
the. I think you know not all the pre-Socratics. I think really the Atomists.
Yes.
You know, is
right.
There and. So we need to establish his efficient cause.
Right.
So yeah. So it's interesting the relationship with Plato. But I mean,
yeah.
I do think he's thinking. I mean, later on he'll say different passages that no one really got the efficient cause right of my predecessors. But you know, Empedocles and Democritus were almost there. Not Democritus. Empedocles and Anaxagoras were almost there.
Right.
And so I think. That was also sort of
right.
helping when I first
right.
was trying to go this route. because I think, just no one to dwell on the feet all the time, but that he thinks Plato was right there to say, yes, something was right about Anaxagoras putting in mind, but I think he thinks Plato goes astray partly because, and maybe bring in your final cause partly at this point, that like he says, well, actually, no, we need to posit the forms, which are the final cause and culminating in the good, and then we have the soul, which is emotion, which is moves itself and moves the body. So it is not an unmoved mover. It's in the realm of things that are moved. It's moved by the body. It moves the body.
Right.
You know, when the child is born, all the circles are all screwed up because of so much incoming nutriment and so forth. And so there's a kind of mechanistic relationship between the soul and the body. And then when the soul starts to understand the forms, they can order the body in a certain way. But I think he thinks that Plato went askew there by making the actual efficient cause itself a mover. The soul is the ultimate efficient cause for Plato. And it's moving. It moves things by moving. And I think, no, that's not what Anaxagoras meant. I think, like, going back to Anaxagoras, I mean, because people say in the Phaedo Aristotle is being tendentious to say the form, Plato thinks the forms are efficient causes.
Right.
Because he recognized other places that it's the soul, that's
right.
But I think that he's thinking he's closer to the truth when he gets there. If he should just develop this notion that the forms, as well, his own conceptual course, Aristotle brings the forms into things, but that the forms have a distinctive kind of causality.
Right. So on that, I mean, so I like the way that you sort of appealed to the Phaedo passage to say, look, Aristotle wants to affirm, a very strong dimension of this insight that Socrates articulates in that passage. And then, but he doesn't want to go so far, and is part of the worry that that if you go so far and you make the soul a move mover, that it becomes material, that it becomes only a mechanistic relationship, and you want to make sure we hold open the reading, which is that the soul is not material and yet an efficient cause. Right.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I hadn't really, but it's treating the soul like a material thing.
Right. So then you bring this at the end, toward the end of the essay, which is really, I think, something that I've struggled with and continue to struggle with, these passages in Metaphysics Lambda about God, and about God as, on the one hand, and I make a lot of this in my book about God as eroumenos and as a cause in the sense of a desire, as something that is a desired object and can move. And in fact, one of the things I remember reading in, I think, probably a commentary by Ross about that passage in the Metaphysics, where Aristotle emphasizes that God is a kind of erotic principle, and Ross says something like, this is the only kind of, moving by desire is the only kind of cause in Aristotle that's not reciprocal. And that's why Aristotle's appealing to it in this passage. And so then when you reemphasize the idea, well, wait a minute, efficient causality also isn't reciprocal on the paradigmatic model. I was really interested in it because I thought, okay, well, wait a minute, that was, you know, so I went around just repeating this, you know, truth that Ross articulated. and maybe that's not right. Maybe there is something importantly non-reciprocal about the efficient cause. And then, if that's the case, then I need to rethink and think more deeply about what it means to be, for God to be an efficient cause Aristotle. Because then that becomes actually something more, more interesting, in the sense that it's not God is not this kind of, I mean, it's certainly not something embodied or mechanistic in that sense,
right?
But maybe you could talk a little bit about how you at the end make this conclusion about, you know, God as efficient cause.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think it's very interesting stuff, but you know. Whether it's right or not, we'll see.
Yeah, sure.
But because the whole thing about God is definitely a final cause,
right?
Okay, but how do final causes function? Can they function without efficient causes? Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems to me they can't. And another question, you know, something moves as being loved. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, and there's always the question of like, certain things move us because we desire them, and they don't exist yet. They move us because we want them to exist, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And so maybe, you know, we will separate Eros somehow, must have an actually existing object. But, you know, see, I mean, like, why is it? Why not just have some kind of ideal, sure. you know, that, right. So why does it have to actually be there since you can, you know, entertain mentally objects of desire and then strive to achieve them? So why, you know, wasn't quite sure how the actual existence of the completely actual thing mm-hmm. was needed rather than simply the idea.
Uh-huh.
Unless, you know, mm-hmm. you know, we do a third meditation argument there to get, right. get to the reality, but whatever. So I was trying to think. One of the things in the Lambda passage is that God's not only object of desire, but it's object of intellect, mm-hmm. The highest, noeton, as well mm-hmm. as orekton,
right?
So I began to think. Well, and of course, he moves things that are objects of desire move by being cognized in some mm-hmm, way, mm-hmm. right? And so this, you know, using the, you know, non-metaphorical sense of desire, you know, so the animal desire, animals have to have some either sense perception or fantasy or something mm-hmm. Of the object of their desire in order to have the desire.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, maybe God, so it's got to be present cognitively to these, to the things that end up desiring it. And so, and presumably through its noeton, it's got to be known by
mm-hmm,
them.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to think, well, maybe, then I began to think of the connection with the active intellect, because it looks like there, it's the nous poieti kos, mm-hmm. looks like it's doing something,
right,
you know,
right?
And it's doing something which accounts for some kind of thinking.
Right.
So, well, maybe the qua object of intellect, the God, the prime mover, causes in the way the active intellect does the thinking of itself by mm-hmm. what desires and then thinking of it, seeing how good it is and so forth and so on, they desire it, and so mm-hmm. The activity ensues. But so I thought, you know, in this way it's a cause of motion through exciting desire,
mm-hmm.
and it excites desire because it because I makes itself known, or is the cause of the thinking. Mm-hmm. And insofar as he does look like in 3.5, you know, he needs to invoke a pure actuality in order to explain some kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like we need an efficient cause for thinking, and so mm-hmm. I've got to put those two
mm-hmm.
together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. And then, I mean, it definitely challenges our... the part of the problem and I'm glad that I, you know... I mean, your article really helps in this regard, but part of the problem is the force of the mechanistic examples of efficient causality that are always present in our mind since, you know, at least human, if not before, mm-hmm. of this kind of mechanistic billiard ball model.
Uh-huh.
And when you begin to think of it in terms of, let's say, the paradigm of a techne, of an art, or when you talk about it as the object of intellection, then it definitely transforms the ways in which we understand the final cause in relationship to the efficient cause. And I'm really very much open to that. I do worry that it renders the efficient cause more like the final cause than we're normally used to thinking. But that doesn't mean it's wrong. Mm-hmm. It just means that and one of the things that I think I was thinking along some similar kinds of lines when I was talking in the book on Aristotle and the Nature of Truth about God as a eromenon and the strange passage, part of that passage where Aristotle talks about this principle as not only moving others and not being moved, but moving others toward each other, namely moving things, having an impact on relationships, not just between it and the rest of things, but between all the other interworldly things too. And then having read then your article, I thought, well, maybe that's part of the efficient causal dimension of a God, in the sense that in the same way that a doctor, you know, interacts with another physical human being to bring health about, right? But is not itself, on your view, is not itself the efficient, the final efficient cause, namely the ultimate efficient cause, I should say, which would be the art of doctoring. Right? Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense? So that, you know, I tried to make a something of the fact that it's not just that the principle of God as object of love brings other things in relationship to it, but it also brings other things into relationship with one another, things into relationships with one another.
Right.
And by virtue of that, it is the case that those things are, you know, other worldly things as they relate to one another can act in even in very mechanistic, efficient, causal ways to move people and to move things. And I wonder if there's a way even to get at that kind of conception of noeton and of object of intellect as efficient cause, even in that passages, those passages where, you know, the emphasis is on the object of desire as on the aromenon.
Right. I mean, part of what you said just now about the prime mover not bringing things in relationship to itself, but into each other.
Right.
I think is very interesting, and that that passage in the end of Book Lambda,
right,
where is the order present in the world as in the order of the army, or as in the general, and both,
right,
but more so in the general case,
right,
general, and that's one of the few places that he really, I mean, you know, that I have found that he talks about, you know, things in the world cooperating together,
right,
and having it, and the order needing some kind of principle to,
right,
explain it,
right,
because he's so so frequently works within the individual substance,
yeah,
you know, the parts of a substance all fit together to fit, you know, to for the good of that substance, and how all the substances in the world fit together he seldom talks about,
right.
And so I mean, I'm fascinated by that passage. I'm not quite sure what to do,
right,
with it. And in so far as maybe bringing the efficient cause into closer relationship with the final cause could help make sense of that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah. So one of the things that I at the end of the Aristotle on the Nature of Truth book, or I guess in chapter 7, when I'm trying to deal with some of this. I there's two examples there. The one is the general, and the other is the household.
Right.
I really emphasize the household one because I'm trying to play with the vocabulary of oikos and ecology and all these other things. But also because maybe similar to what you had said originally, which was that sort of the example of the general is still too much almost on the model of a certain kind of production. And it's still too much presumes the independence of the principle from the order,
right.
So for me it's great that he says, well, maybe both, but then he sort of says, well, but more so in the general,
but
then when he articulates the meaning of a household, he doesn't situate any principle outside of the household itself. It whatever principle is there is internal to the household. And so I think that actually would help us think about the imminent nature of the final cause and the imminent nature of the efficient cause on the model that you're talking about. Now, you know, Because I think there's always a tendency to think about things on the model of, or think about causality on the model of production. And as you say, the problem with that is that, well, when the process is over, that's when the result is outside of the process.
Right.
And so an account of the cosmos can't really be given in those terms, because that would require an external principle.
Right.
But, I mean, one of the things, well, maybe this will be, I wonder, and this is pure speculation.
Okay.
Now, I wonder how it came to be that the mechanistic model became the paradigm, you know, for, is that just a late development that comes in with, you know, Newtonian physics and all of that, or is, because I think you make a compelling case that it's really not, that's not the model for Aristotle.
Right.
You know?
Well, I love pure speculation.
Yeah,
and as much as I would love to blame the 17th century. it is weird, because I do think, you know, the early atomists had such a view.
Right.
You know, the early atomists. And that's what so when people talk about, you know, Democritean necessity in Aristotle, it's like the last thing he wants to admit, anything like that.
Right.
Anyway, but they did have it, and I think, you know, this other strand, the Empedoclean and Anaxagorean strand of pre-Socratic philosophy is something that, you know, both Aristotle and Plato picked up on, and it became dominant. And I think one of the interesting things, to really go speculative, is the effect on later atomism. Because I think Epicurus was sensitive to the criticisms of Aristotle. And, I mean, that, a lot of people know that, to Democritus. And sort of with the swerve, sort of add something in, you know, it's a different kind of causation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not, there's no teleology there, there's no,
right.
But it's just something that starts things moving, you know.
Right.
So really, and maybe, like, going back to, in some ways, like Anaxagoras, without any principle of what is the mind doing,
it's
just starting the motion.
Right.
And so, but the idea that you need something that's different in kind from just the mechanical causation, I think is, you know, apparently was really powerful and got a big hold. And I think even in the Stoics, the cause and effect of the interesting relationship between there is not at all the mechanistic model.
Right.
So then the question is, why did it come back? But I think it was always there, sort of, so maybe it's a latent temptation.
Right. And is it a temptation to be reductive, to try and do away with that kind of difference? Is that what you're saying? So that what Anaxagoras gave us is the recognition, as you said earlier, that there's this difference between the cause, the principle, and that which it orders, right? And there's a tendency on a mechanistic model is to simply to try to reduce those so that it's just physical motion.
Right. Maybe that temptation comes in as an attempt, right? Just to bracket, you know, those might be important questions, but we can bracket those and do so much, you know, without them,
Yeah, to try and give an account completely without relying on anything that's that's, you know, radically other than the thing you're trying to give an account of, right? That anything that requires an appeal to something beyond just the mechanistic relationships.
Right.
So, well, Tom, this has been a great digital dialogue. Thank you so much for coming on and discussing efficient causality with me.
It's been very fun. Great. Thank you very much.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/digital. CPL2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of the Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.